Welcome to the Forensic Nutritionist Podcast. My name is Fiona Tuck. I'm a nutritional medicine practitioner and a qualified skin therapist for over 25 years. The Forensic Nutritionist Podcast takes an investigative approach into all things nutrition, gut health, and skin, using qualified experts to bring you information that you can trust. We are all unique. The information presented herein is not intended to diagnose, to treat, or cure disease. Please seek professional medical guidance prior to modifying any diet, exercise, or lifestyle program. Let us begin. On the podcast today, we have Dr. Christine Horton. She has over 30 years' experience in clinical nutrition and has extensive knowledge in biochemistry, nutrigenomics, and is currently engaged in research and development of high-quality nutraceuticals and functional food products. Dr. Christine is passionate about promoting and teaching both health professionals and individuals how to achieve optimal health as naturally as possible. Her field of research is in biochemistry and nutrigenomics. Dr. Christine, thank you so much for taking time out to chat to us today.
Fiona, it's a pleasure to join you.
Well, I'm so excited that you agreed to come on the podcast because I have been in your training and you are a mine of information. I could literally listen to you all day. And your training courses, the one I attended, it really was one of the best trainings that I've been to. So I feel very honoured that you're taking time to chat to us today.
That's a pleasure.
On a very, very fascinating and interesting subject, which is nutrigenomics. Can you tell us briefly a little bit about your background in nutrition and what made you go on to research such a fascinating topic?
Well, it's a rather long story, Fiona, but I'll try to keep it as short as possible. I think as a teenager, I really enjoyed cooking, and that sort of started out an interest in food, and then I became interested in the importance of food. And my mother, I think, was well ahead of her time, and she was very interested in the idea of food and health. And so I picked that up, and I always had a particular bent for biological sciences. So I did biochemistry at university with a view to doing something in nutrition, although I wasn't quite sure what that might be. And I embarked on a semester of dietetics, and I just found that was a little bit too restrictive for what I wanted to do. But the more I read of biochemistry, the more I could see that the logic was there, because our body is really made up of the molecules which we eat and breathe and drink. And so it was perfectly logical to me that what I ate had a marked effect on the outcome of what's going on in my body. So I took a bit of a sidetrack from there, and I became a chiropractor, and I practice as a chiropractor in clinics in Brisbane over the best part of 30 years. But because of my real interest in food and nutrition, I gradually incorporated that knowledge into my practice. Around about the late 70s, this concept of vitamin therapy and also molecular nutrition and so on started to become better known and better understood. So I was already well placed to get interested in that subject, because I already had the biochemical background. And so to me, it was just a natural progression over time. And then later, I did formal studies in nutrition, and finally leading to a PhD.
Fascinating. And I'm so on the same wavelength as you. To me, it makes total sense about food, nutrition, and, you know, how it is all biochemistry related. But I know your philosophy is always really to look at food first rather than turn immediately to sort of supplements and vitamins. And unfortunately, I think it's a bit of a path that a lot of nutritionists and naturopaths go down straight away. Can you explain to us the concept of nutrigenomics and what exactly that is and what that means?
Well, the term was actually coined about 2004, and I didn't hear about it for a couple of years. But when you think about the word, it's easy to understand what it means. So nutra as in food, genomics as in gene. So that's related to food talking to genes. Pardon me. So different molecules within our food can influence the expression of genes. So the healthier the food you're eating, the more you're switching on protective genes, and vice versa. If you're eating junk food, you're switching on pro-inflammatory and disease-causing genes.
Yep, absolutely. And I guess, I mean, it does seem really obvious that there seems to be this move towards eating more processed food, and is now everything is fast food. And even with the new plant-based and vegan movement, a lot of that food coming out is highly processed and what I would refer to as fake food. And it's interesting, you know, since having all this processed food and even the additives and emulsifiers that are going into these foods and preservatives, to me, it seems a no-brainer that this is why we're seeing, or it has to be linked to, why we're seeing so much more disease and allergies and autoimmune type conditions.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And it's only in recent times that we've understood how some of these food additives are damaging the microbiome. So this little colony of friendly bacteria that live within our digestive tract is highly susceptible to the foods that we eat. And some of these food elements are quite frankly toxic to the microbiota.
Yes.
And we are so highly dependent on our relationship with the microbiota that it's no wonder that we are initiating a whole host of diseases which we've not seen to the same extent in the past, because the 80% of our immune system actually resides directly underneath the lining of the digestive tract. And so when you eat a food that's adversely affecting the lining of the gut, it's going to have an influence on the immune system. And the immune system is really regulating conditions like infection, inflammation, allergy, and autoimmunity. And it's a whole new field we're really only now beginning to understand more fully.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating area. And I think what a lot of people don't realise is a lot of these additives are also in supposedly healthy foods, or, you know, processed health foods. And so I think it's in so many foods that we really need to start reading labels. And I guess even some of those additives aren't even on the label, are they?
Well, that's true, because we have this classification of additives which are actually called food processing aids, which is a little bit of a subtle difference, but you're not required as a food manufacturer to put a food processing aid on the label, whereas you're required to put an additive. And there's a popularly used material called transglutaminase, which is in baked goods, it's in desserts, it's in dairy foods, it's in a whole host of commercially made processed foods. And it has very severely adverse effects on the way the gut functions. And what's rather unfortunate is it's even in gluten-free foods. So where we look at the tight junctions which open and close within the lining of the gut, these transglutaminase molecules actually open those little junctions wider than they should be. So we're allowing toxic materials and unwanted bacteria to get into the immune system and then get into the bloodstream. And yet for people who are on a gluten-free diet, they're trying to avoid gluten doing that, and yet they're having other additives in their gluten-free processed foods that are doing exactly the same thing. It really comes back to the need for us, I think, to just get back to buying raw ingredients and preparing our own foods. Because wherever you look at the processed food industry, there's going to be a problem somewhere or another. And when, you know, in my childhood, quite a long time ago, we had very few processed foods. And the ones that we had were more or less for a treat. You know, it was your birthday, it was Christmas, and
yes,
your parents would buy these things. Now they've become everyday additions to children's school lunchboxes and adults' snacking habits. So we have lots of trouble within the health community, and it's, to me, it's an absolute travesty that this isn't talked about more widely. It should be discussed in the doctor's surgery and not wait till, you know, people have to read articles in magazines or Google online or visit non-mainstream clinicians to find answers. I mean, it's almost as if these answers are hidden well out of the way, and yet we know what's causing chronic disease to continue to accelerate. It yeah. isn't a secret. It's just that the food industry isn't going to help us to bring that message out.
I think that's it, and it is the food industry, and I think, you know, the majority of people and families are shopping in supermarkets, and the majority of food in supermarkets, unless you're sort of buying that fresh produce, is full of the ingredients and additives. So I do think it is something that we do need to talk more about and make people aware of that. So I do think it's something important to highlight. Now, it's something that I wanted to have a chat to you about, because I know you've done a lot of research in this area, is the topic of sulforaphane. So when we were actually talking about nutrigenomics and eating more fresh foods, we seem to be having more of an awareness now of the health benefits of certain foods, and broccoli is always being heralded as a superfood. But I know you've actually done a lot of research on the health benefits of the compound sulforaphane, which we get from broccoli and some cruciferous vegetables. Can you talk to us a little bit about sulforaphane? What is it? Where does it come from? How is it formed? And what are some of those health benefits from it?
I would love to talk about that, Fiona. That's kind of my favourite subject. So if we just go back to 1992, the first of the research was done on this then. So there was a group of scientists at Johns Hopkins University in the US who had looked at this sulforaphane and other compounds coming from the broccoli family of vegetables. And they discovered that the greater concentration of this material was found in the broccoli sprout. I actually tell a lie there. It isn't found in the sprout. The sprout makes it. Let me explain what I mean. Yep. So if we think about a broccoli seed, which is a tiny little brown inconsequential seed, it's got two little sacs inside it, which are needed to make the sulforaphane. So one of those little sacs has a molecule called glucoraphanin in it, and the other one has a molecule called myrosinase, which is an enzyme. And so they're kept apart within the seed. So as the broccoli seed is germinated and starts to grow in, first of all, into a sprout, and then as time goes by, it grows into the full head of broccoli vegetable that we recognise, the glucoraphanin and the myrosinase just get diluted as the plant grows. So you have very concentrated amounts in the seed and the young sprout, and not so much in the mature vegetable. When you eat the sprout or eat the vegetable, those two little sacs get broken up, and the myrosinase enzyme acts on the glucoraphanin in its sac and produces the sulforaphane. So it's basically produced as you eat it. So as you chew and bite, it's being produced. Right. And that sulforaphane molecule, as it turned out, is about 50 to 100 times more concentrated in the sprout than it is in the vegetable. So the scientists at Johns Hopkins University then decided to do their research on the broccoli sprouts. And they found with a number of their lab studies that they had that the sulforaphane had very protective effects against the development of cancer in certain human cells. And so this began, almost 30 years now of research that's really accelerating in the properties of sulforaphane how it's protective, how it isn't just about protecting against cancer, how it can help all sorts of day-to-day conditions which we're familiar with. And so it wasn't for a couple of years after they discovered sulforaphane that another group of scientists found that there was what we'll call a switch in human cells. The switch has got a name called NRF2. But if you can activate this switch, you then switch on hundreds of genes in human cells that protect the cells in many, many different ways. And it was discovered that sulforaphane is the most potent activator of this switch. And so began this long progression of research into sulforaphane and what it can do. And because it's such a potent activator of these protective genes, it was discovered that you can have modest doses of this and get a very significant effect. And on top of that, it's very well absorbed into cells. So for a couple of reasons, sulforaphane is a standout molecule when we're looking at the sorts of molecules which are found in plant foods and which are of benefit. Now, that's not to say that it's the only thing that's helpful. That's not true. Mm. But all of our plant foods will have some ability to activate NRF2. And if you eat a large array of different plant foods, you have lots of vegetables every day and fruits, you will get an activation of NRF2. But for most people, it's appalling in Australia and other first world countries. It is something like 92% of Australian adults don't get the required serves of fruit and vegetables daily. In fact, I think it's actually more like 96% in the last survey. This is absolutely appalling.
That's because shocking.
We know that plant foods are highly protective against disease. And countries like the Mediterranean countries eating their traditional diets where they have lots and lots of plants, in fact, 4 to 5 times more plant food daily in the traditional Mediterranean diet than we have in our Australian diet. So we know there is power in plant foods. What we didn't know until the last couple of decades is that these plant molecules are not just about vitamins and minerals and deficiencies. They're really about switching on protective genes. And that's where the whole focus of nutrigenomics has changed the way we look at nutrition, that we're now looking at food molecules with nutrigenomic activity. And that's where sulforaphane shines, because it's right up the top of the tree. It's, you know, much higher up the top of the tree than molecules you hear about like curcumin and resveratrol and silymarin and some of those other popular supplemental food molecules that we find available.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is where, in a way, it's a little bit crazy that I guess as humans we look at plants and then think, well, let's extract a vitamin, make synthetic high dose vitamins and let's give those to people. But it's so obvious that really if we eat the whole plant food, we're not just getting the nutrients, the vitamins and minerals, but we're getting those important plant compounds, which are what are also having that effect on the biochemistry of the body. And the Mediterranean diet and lifestyle is really proof, living proof of that. Yet we still want to go down this avenue of just pop a pill and eat the processed food. So I think it really is something that we need to educate people about so much more. But good news, something that I found out this week, which excites me a lot, is that Woolworths have just started selling broccoli sprouts. So I was very excited to hear that. So broccoli sprouts are, you know, such a good source of the sulforaphane, but I guess one of the issues is actually where do you buy them from or where do you get them from? So having them available in the supermarket, that was something I got a little bit excited about.
Because they're actually fairly difficult to grow at home. If you're in the habit of growing things like alfalfa sprouts and mung bean sprouts, they're fairly easy. Broccoli sprouts will get very slimy and very moldy quickly if you're not familiar with what you're doing. The real problem we have with growing our own sprouts, however, is the starting level of glucoraphanin in the seed, because we've got no way of knowing whether we've got a high glucoraphanin in the seed we're sprouting or not. So I usually recommend that if people want to use fresh broccoli sprouts as their source of sulforaphane, they really have to eat around about 100 grams of those sprouts every day at least to get a therapeutic effect. And the reason I say that is that there have been a couple of clinical trials where they have used 100 grams of sprouts and they've got a beneficial outcome. But if you want to get the sprouts and measure them out on the scales, 100 grams of light, fluffy sprouts is actually quite a large volume. So
it is, yeah.
A couple of little pinches on the side of your salad isn't really going to make much difference.
I actually sometimes put them in a smoothie as well to try and up the broccoli sprouts. But you can actually get broccoli sprout powder as well, can't you? You can get the dried form.
Yes, well, that's what a lot of my research was based on. So in order that we could do some clinical trials with live human beings, we had to make something that was convenient. So we had to grow the sprout to its optimum sulforaphane level, dry it, powder it, have it in capsules, and then we could give the individuals in the studies 2 to 4 capsules daily. So that's the convenient way of doing it, and a lot of my work is in educating clinicians, and so they of course are looking for a powder or a capsule that they can give to their patients as a therapeutic dose and with a predictable dose that's going to match what the clinical trials show. So there's two ways of looking at it. You know, if you're generally healthy and you just want to prevent future diseases and stay healthy, by all means, have sprouts regularly, broccoli sprouts. If you've got a particular condition and you're looking for a particular therapeutic outcome, it's probably a good idea to have the broccoli sprout as a measured dose in a standardized supplement. So whichever the individual prefers to do, or you can do both.
And with the actual myrosinase enzyme, does that get destroyed by cooking or heat or even by the drying process? I presume.
Well, that's really the trap. So we only have to cook fresh broccoli vegetable a very, very small amount, like a couple of minutes, which is not enough to soften it or cook it, and you've killed that enzyme. So if you don't have the myrosinase enzyme, you can't form the sulforaphane from the glucoraphanin, and that's the trap. So I encourage people, if you're using fresh broccoli, eat cooked broccoli if you want, but realise that to get the real benefit out of it, you need to probably crumble up the little florets and stir it into your tossed salad or stir it into a casserole or something like that just before you're serving it. Because once you cook it, you've lost the enzyme. Now, there is some ability of the gut microflora to convert some of that glucoraphanin into sulforaphane, but it's very limited. It's less than 10% of what comes naturally with the plant. And the real problem now is so many people, particularly those who are not well, have a disturbed microbiome anyway, and they've got no way of knowing whether they're able to convert anything much at all. And if you've been on antibiotics recently, I'm quite sure you're not able to convert that glucoraphanin to the sulforaphane that's bioactive.
Yeah. And with the sulforaphane, I know we were saying it may help to protect from certain disease and cancers. Can you expand on some of the health benefits from having sulforaphane in the diet?
Do you want to talk about cancer prevention, or do you want to talk about disease in general?
A little bit of both. So, if you could just maybe on cancer prevention, but just some of the other diseases it may be beneficial to help to protect.
So most of the cancer prevention research has been done either in animals or in the lab using cancer cells in petri dishes. That's because the development of cancer can take a person's lifetime, so we haven't had enough time to see whether it's preventive over decades. And also, it would not be ethical to run a clinical trial on cancer patients and give them a supplement when there are established ways of dealing with that disease. So from an animal standpoint, we know that animals can be prevented from developing cancers by the presence of sulforaphane, although you can't always directly translate that to humans.
Yep.
And in line with a number of other diseases, because the main functions that sulforaphane is doing is it's enhancing the function of every cell in the body. So it helps the cell to produce its own detoxification enzymes. It helps the cell to produce its own antioxidant enzymes, which are many, many times more powerful than any antioxidant supplement one might buy. And all of these hundreds of protective compounds are produced in every cell of the body. So therefore, you can't say sulforaphane is good for this disease or that disease or protective against a particular disease. It's improving the function of the entire body. And hopefully, in a person with a particular genetic weakness, it helps them to overcome part of the effects of that genetic weakness. Now, one of the first clinical trials that was done with sulforaphane was on looking at type 2 diabetes. So this was done in Iran, and they had two groups of people. One group was given broccoli sprouts, the equivalent of 40 milligrams sulforaphane a day, which is quite a large dose. And the other group who did exactly the same but had no sulforaphane. And at the end of 30 days, they measured a whole lot of markers associated with cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. So that's things like cholesterol levels and triglyceride levels and other diabetic markers. And they found a significant benefit for the 30-day treatment in those who had the sulforaphane. So that was pretty exciting as a first step. Yeah, and since then, there have been other studies that have looked at diseases like asthma and autism and Helicobacter infection in the stomach, which can lead to stomach cancer anyway. Certainly looking at protection against environmental pollutants. So there was there've been a couple of studies done in China where the smog can often be quite bad, and they've looked at being able to protect people against the effect of those pollutants. And part of that is because sulforaphane increases the activity of the detoxification enzymes in the cell. So if you are inhaling motor vehicle exhaust fumes, let's say, you're then able to break down those molecules more quickly if the sulforaphane is functioning as it should. The autism study is an interesting one because you think, you know, what has that got to do with the other diseases that we're talking about? And we don't entirely know all of the mechanisms as to how it works, but most certainly autism is associated with inflammatory changes in the gut and also inflammatory changes in the brain, among other things. And it's quite possible that sulforaphane's effect in both of those areas in down-regulating inflammation has been the reason that they have benefited from that. Certainly in gut health, we see a lot of benefits. And as you know from a seminar of mine that you attended recently, we spend a lot of time talking about the benefit of sulforaphane in gut health. So it's widespread in its ability to prevent disease in general.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, that's the importance of not only including sulforaphane, but including, you know, such a broad variety of plants so that we are getting the plant compounds and this NRF2 activation, because that's what's seemingly helping to down-regulate these pro-inflammatory pathways and help the body produce its own antioxidants.
Yes, exactly. And I often talk about the need for individuals to have at least 660 grams of non-starchy vegetables daily. And the reason I talk about that is because a German study was done a few years ago where they compared the effect on markers of inflammation in the blood on individuals taking different amounts of plant foods. and they found the ones with the greatest benefit and the greatest reduction in their inflammation markers were those who were eating around 660 grams daily of non-starchy plant foods, which is partly why I recommend that. And then there was another study done a little bit later on that actually brought the dose up to 800 grams a day for people preventing cardiovascular disease. So there's no doubt that we need to eat plant food. That doesn't mean one has to become a vegetarian, not at all, but it certainly means that we need to get rid of the junky processed food that is crowding out the space in which we could put more vegetables.
Absolutely. And I mean, 800 grams is a lot. I actually, you know, my husband and I eat a lot of vegetables, and I'm happy to say we would be getting to that. But I would say, well, you've already said, you know, up to 96% of Australians aren't eating enough vegetables. And I think it's a really good description, or, you know, advice to say at least look at trying to get 600 grams of veggies in and actually weigh it, because when you look at how much that is, that's quite a lot of vegetables.
It is, and that's the first thing that I ask patients to do. When you go home, take out of the fridge all the vegetables that you think you would eat in an average day, get the kitchen scales and just weigh them and get an idea of what we're talking about. And if you feel you can't eat those vegetables as they are, you can always make them into soups and juices and look at using them in other creative ways. It doesn't have to be just steaming them and putting them on the side of the plate, which can be a little bit boring. So lots of things you can do, but it takes a little bit of effort. And I think there's a bit of a mindset now that we tend to say, oh, I haven't got time for that. But really, if you haven't got time to take care of your health and you don't have your health, I don't think you've got time for anything else. And it's just a mindset. And I think once you get around that, and you only have to learn half a dozen, you know, dishes that you can create quickly and easily and confidently with a little bit of variety in there, that I think you can get a handle on this cooking thing without having to resort to buying the garbage.
I agree, absolutely. And things like stir fries and little veggie soups can be very, very quick to make. And again, prepping as well, you know, prep some of the veggies at the weekend, and then you're ready to go for the week if you do have that busy lifestyle. So there definitely are ways around it. And I guess the message is to start to increase plant foods as a preventative. And because I do find that people tend to want to do something about their health when it's too late or when there's a health scare. And I think making that change beforehand, that is what is so important, rather than wait till disease has actually happened. So I think that's really great advice there. When we're talking about the NRF2 activation and increasing plants in the diet, where do you stand, Christine, with things like synthetic vitamins? Do we know the kind of effect they would have on the NRF2 activation?
I'm glad you mentioned that. They don't actually have any effect on activating NRF2, but unfortunately, high doses of antioxidant vitamin supplements can actually shut down the effect of NRF2. So let me explain what I mean by that. So NRF2 is attached to another molecule that's like a television antenna, and your cells are constantly monitoring their environment. And if there appears to be some sort of stress in the neighbourhood, so let's suppose somebody smoking cigarettes on the bus stop and you're sitting at the other end of the seat, your system is detecting those cigarette toxins that you're inhaling, and your cells are saying, we'll have problems here if we don't ramp up our defences. So that is like a signal that says to NRF2, okay, switch on and start producing these protective compounds and then we won't have a problem. Now, what has that got to do with plant foods? Well, a lot of the molecules in plant foods, and we'll use sulforaphane again as an example, although it's many, many plant molecules. These molecules are actually weak prooxidants. And when they get into the cell says, oh, I might have a problem here with these prooxidants here, so I better switch on my antioxidants. Now, the problem is that signal, if you then dump a whole lot of vitamin C and E into the cell in high dose, which you can easily get from a couple of pills, you are now masking that weak pro-oxidant signal that the cell needs to switch on its defences. It completely hides that signal and the cell does not switch on its defences. A very good study was done a few years ago on some exercising young men. They were divided into two groups and they were put onto a pretty intensive exercise program for 30 days. One group was given 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C and 400 units of vitamin E daily, and the other group had no supplements. Both of them did the same exercise routine. At the end of the 30 days, they tested their blood for a whole lot of markers related to metabolic syndrome, diabetes, cardiovascular risk, and that sort of thing. What they expected to find was that those who had the exercise plus the vitamins would have a better response than those who just exercised. And in fact, they found completely the opposite. The ones who had taken the vitamins as well as the exercise got zero benefit from the exercise, whereas those who did the intensive exercise got the predicted benefit. So that kind of rocked the socks off some of the scientific community because they didn't understand at that time why this was happening. So anyone who's heard me speak for any length of time will know that I speak actively against megadosing vitamin supplements. You will get all the vitamin C you need out of a couple of pieces of fruit a day, some tomatoes, some raw capsicum, and so on. You do not need to dose with vitamin C. It's been the greatest marketing success of all time in the supplement industry, but the message is wrong. And the message about it being beneficial to the immune system is mostly wrong. The bit that's not wrong about vitamin C in the immune system is that cells of the immune system, like macrophages and neutrophils and so on, do concentrate vitamin C in their cells. But because they're more concentrated in those cells than they are, say, in skin cells, doesn't mean that we have to megadose them. It just means that the body distributes the vitamin C unevenly according to where it needs it. So there's a lot we have to unlearn. And unfortunately, I remember when I was in my early days of practice in the 70s, the megavitamin era was just getting started. And the message at the time was, there's nothing left in your food, take my multivitamin supplement. And unfortunately, people bought the story and they believed it. And that story's never gone away. And we still have people saying, everyone knows there's nothing left in your food. It's not true. Modern agriculture has changed the concentration of nutrients in the soil, but nowhere near to the extent that we're led to believe. It's a marketing story and it was a successful one, and it's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, the plants wouldn't grow if there was no nutrients in the soil. Anyway.
They don't grow. And not only that, even mild deficiencies of mineral nutrients in plants will quickly show up. I remember learning botany at university and, you know, some would have yellow crinkled leaves and someone had a different shape depending on what nutrient was not in its adequate amount. So the story gets beaten up, and unfortunately for the average consumer, how does one know where to go for the right information? Because you're bombarded by so much information now, what you call fake nutrition, fake news or something, and you don't know how to sort it out. So it's rather difficult. That's why I guess people like you and me having these sorts of conversations can at least help to put some of the facts into context.
Yeah, I mean, I could not agree with you more, and my stance is exactly the same as yours, and I think long-term high-dose supplementation where there's going to be side effects. It's like medication. You take a medication, then you have to take another medication for the side effect of the first medication. And the way I see vitamin supplementation, that it's really going down the same route. But unfortunately, I think where the information is misleading, that the majority of nutritionists and naturopaths are trained to see a client and hear that they're stressed and then say, well, then you need B vitamins, vitamin C and magnesium, and here's your supplements. So I think that's where I guess education even needs to come back to a professional level and really go back to basics and start looking at nutrition from food and really looking at biochemistry and nutrigenomics and how that works, so that we can understand that on more of a biochemical level. That's my thoughts on that.
I agree. And the other thing to add to that, I think, is that a lot of people are thinking that when they take a vitamin supplement, they're taking something natural. There's nothing natural about a vitamin C supplement or any other vitamin supplement. They're not made out of foods. They're made in a factory. Vitamin C is actually made from variations of the sugar molecule, which is being tinkered around with in a factory to produce the ascorbic acid, which is a similar molecule to that which is found in a food. But the thing about the food is the food comes with a whole lot of other molecules for the ride. It's coming with all sorts of other phytochemicals, and we know a little bit about some of those phytochemicals, but we don't know everything about all of them. And this is where we took the wrong fork in the road back in the day, when we thought the more antioxidants you could get in your diet, the better you were going to be, and started this mega vitamin era of you could never have too much vitamin C or E or beta carotene.
Yep.
Not realizing that the reason that plant foods were promoting so many health outcomes was not the vitamins, it was these other molecules. And we didn't even know that nutrigenomics existed until 2004. And so we had no way of knowing that this was anything than a vitamin mineral story. And of course, the supplement industry has hung on to this and isn't going to let go of it.
No, absolutely.
And as you say, the education of clinicians, which I think starts out looking at food and nutrition, and then somehow or other sidetracks itself off to having to have a lot of supplements. Now, I'm not anti-nutrient supplements where they're necessary, and sometimes people can have become so deficient over such a long history of eating poorly that it's a good idea to use a well-chosen couple of supplements to kick things along, but that's only while you're getting the food in place and giving them an opportunity to learn how to prepare these foods and overcome the weaknesses that are there, and then gradually you can phase out the supplement.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, and I think there does need to be more education about that. But I think one of the issues as well is that, you know, these professional supplementation companies for practitioners, you know, a lot of them are just pushing synthetic supplements and vitamins. And I think when we can go back to more natural sources and getting the nutrients from whole foods, that's when, I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? That's what's been happening with the Mediterranean diet, the Mediterranean lifestyle, looking at the blue zones. If you look at the foods they eat and the lifestyle they have, they're the areas where people live the longest with the lowest rate of disease. They're all living really from on the basis of nutrigenomics, aren't they? They're not popping the pills and taking the medication, which is interesting, and really it shouldn't be surprising, yet we still try and get that quick fix here in the West.
Yes, unfortunately that is exactly what's happening. And a lot of those traditional diets that you mentioned, particularly the Mediterranean diet, was born out of poverty. They knew nothing about nutrition, but they couldn't afford to eat lots of animal foods, so they didn't. They had to rely on gathering wild plants, you know, green leaves from the fields. The women would recognise different weeds that had health-promoting benefits. And they would rely on a lot of legumes, which are cheap. So legumes and grains and nuts and seeds and plants and fermented foods and a little bit of dairy and eggs and meat. That's essentially the Mediterranean diet. Of course, the olive oil and their olives, and a bit of red wine. And it stood them the test of time. I'm not sure we should say, though, that the modern Mediterranean diet is quite like that, Fiona.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're talking the traditional, not the modern Mediterranean, which now is sort of Western processed fast food. So absolutely.
But you know, if you go to Melbourne still, and possibly other parts of Australia, there are elderly Greeks living in communities there where they're still practicing that traditional lifestyle. They have their little vegetable garden. And so those elderly people are outside every day. They're in the fresh air. They're getting sunshine. They're getting exercise. They're growing their own plants. They enjoy the cultural experience of producing nice homemade meals for the family. This is the Mediterranean lifestyle, and you can still lead that in a city community. So unfortunately, those elderly people are going to die out in time, but they're still a model for the way the traditional Mediterranean diet works, and they're also a model for good health and longevity.
Absolutely. And I think the movement is so important as well. And it's really interesting, going back to what you were saying about the study that was done with exercise and those that exercise and took the synthetic vitamin supplements didn't get such a good result. And I find that really interesting. And I guess in a way, exercise can also help stimulate that NRF2 activation.
It does, most definitely. I mean, no one's known about sulforaphane supplements until the last 20 years or so. So how has nature sustained us on this planet for so long?
Yeah.
It's just a broad array of different foods, fresh air, sunshine. It's the same thing. And there are many ways of stimulating NRF2, but the important thing to remember is that the body's defences work on receiving signals from the environment and they're stress signals, and the body responds in its own way. So as I said earlier, we come in there and we want to dump a whole lot of synthetic antioxidant vitamins, supplements into the cell and expect that to replicate what nature does. I mean, it's really quite laughable when you think about it.
Yes.
Because nature has so many subtle, internal, intricate control mechanisms that are constantly monitoring that cellular environment and switching certain things on and switching other things off continuously every moment of the day. And we come in there with our big jackhammer and just dump it into the cell and go, here, have these antioxidants and vitamins, we know what's best for you. And, of course, it's nonsense.
Yep. And it is like a jackhammer, really. So, in a way, we're doing more harm than good long term. And, again, I think that study just sort of proves case in point that you're sort of losing those benefits by then bringing a sledgehammer or jackhammer in and sort of shocking everything so that the body doesn't have that sensitivity, I guess, to work with.
Mm. The other thing about supplements that I would like to mention is it's very popular, I see these days, for people to be taking magnesium supplements in particular. It seems like zinc and magnesium are two popular supplements.
Yes.
But it's the minerals like magnesium and zinc and others are carried into the cells by little transporters. And so it's almost like a little ferry, and the mineral has to get on the ferry to cross from one side of the cell to the other to be absorbed. They're all competing for the same transporter. So if you're going to give large amounts of magnesium and zinc, then there's no room on that ferry for the other minerals, things like manganese that might also need to get into the cell. So I think in the process of trying to correct a deficiency in one mineral, you can very readily create an imbalance and reduce the absorption of others. And again, this is why I encourage people to look at whole foods. So you can look at things like cashews and pumpkin seeds, pepitas, and you can look at the fact that they're high in magnesium, they're high in calcium, they're high in zinc, they're high in manganese and iron, and if you eat a wide array of different nuts and seeds, you're going to get all of those minerals and everything else that Mother Nature has tucked away inside those foods without the risk of imbalance.
Yes. I couldn't agree more with you, and that's something I say to people all the time. And it's this thought that we have, and we just don't seem to be moving away from it, that if a little bit is good, more must be better. It's something in human nature that we hear something is good for us, and then we think, well, then we're just going to get a lot of it. And then people still think that they need to take these high dose supplements. And I think you've just explained it so beautifully that hopefully the penny will drop with a lot of people after listening to this. So thank you so much for that, Christine. I could talk to you all day. You're a mine of information, and you explain things so well in such a common sense way that, as you said, some of the things that we do to think we're being healthy, it's laughable when we actually really look at the biochemistry and the science behind it. So I think the way you've explained everything so clearly is so helpful. Can you, before we finish up, because I know there will be practitioners and health professionals listening, can you tell us a little bit about the education that you do? Because you actually run courses, don't you, in nutrigenomics?
Yes, I am co-author of a couple of courses in nutrigenomics. My colleague, Dr. Yael Joffa in South Africa, is a global expert in nutrigenetics. So that's where you have a test done of your DNA and you have a look at the patterns of genes and SNPs, which are like variations in your genes that determine how you respond to the environment and to food. So she handles that area. I handle the nutrigenomics, which is which foods can activate which genes. So we do those courses through ctgeducation.com, which is domiciled in South Africa. And in addition to that, I in Brisbane am involved in teaching clinicians the GEM protocol, which is gut ecology and metabolic modulation, where we look at using gut health as the gateway to dealing with disease and chronic disease in particular. Yes. So those are the things that keep me fairly busy, yes.
And I can highly recommend the GEM protocol training, which I did. And again, it was all very common sense and practical information in taking a very natural approach, which I absolutely loved. So, Dr. Christine, I can't thank you enough for chatting with us today. You're a wealth of information, and I'm sure you've really helped a lot of people that have been listening today. If anybody wants to be in contact with you, how can people reach you? Do you have a website?
Yes, you could go to our website, which is Cell Logic. So it's www.cell-logic.com.au, and we're in Brisbane, Australia.
Yep, wonderful. Christine, thank you so much.
It's been a lot of fun, Fiona. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.